Sometimes we have to hike miles and miles out. There seems to be more aviation every year, so often we can get a helicopter to at least sling our gear out, because each of us has over 135 pounds to carry when we're coming off these fires, with all our tools and camping gear and all our jump gear and our parachutes and everything. So sometimes we have to carry it all off, and sometimes we can get a ride on a helicopter. Sometimes our gear gets blown off and we hike.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. This is episode 100 of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast Trail Talk, and I'd like to take a minute to say thank you for listening. Most podcasts don't make it past episode 20 because of the fact when you start off, you're doing good if you have 10 listeners and one of them is probably your mother. I am also grateful to my early guests who are willing to come on the show when I only had 50 or so listeners each week. But most of all, I'm thankful for you listening right now. I know you have a lot of choices for podcasts to listen to. There's a lot of running podcasts out there, a lot of good content. I'm honored that you are here and spend time listening to the stories that I share. For this episode, my guest is Martha Shuppie. Martha is an ultra runner, but she also has to have the same kind of mindset and determination in her job because Martha is a smoke jumper. That means she jumps out of planes, parachutes into the forest with about 135 pounds of gear and tools to fight forest fires. And she told me that usually that there are only one or two of them that will go depending on the size of the fire. So it's very remote locations and takes a very special mindset to do that kind of a thing. I was able to catch up with Martha on her way to after fighting the fire in New Mexico. She was on the road back to her base in Utah. It was good to talk with her, and she has some good things to share. Here's my conversation with Martha Shuppie. You have an interesting story, and I know you're a smoke jumper, and so I just like that's fascinating to me. And then you're also an ultramarathon runner, so I. Kind of guess what? How did you get decide? You know, as a career path. I mean, when you go to a high school guidance counselor, that's probably not in their anywhere in their list of potential careers. So, how did you decide on? I think I want to be fight fires and be a smoke jumper.
I actually didn't start fighting fires until I was 30.
Wow!
So I was doing all sorts of things before that. When I was in college, I figured I would work in the sciences somehow. And then my first job after college was working at a wilderness therapy program for adjudicated teens. And it was in the desert, south central Utah, so red desert country, mm-hmm. Wayne County. And so just moving out west, you're surrounded by rock climbers and mountain bikers and mountaineers and... So I got into that outdoor lifestyle, and often seasonal work comes with that. Gives you time to go and play and do fun trips. And so I worked I worked all types of jobs, most of them outdoors, through my 20s. Okay. And in there, I worked for the Forest Service doing wilderness trails and got my red card. So I got the classes that you would need to fight wildfires. Just to be able to be allowed on the line.
Okay.
And so, then it was actually 5 years later I got on a fire.
Okay. So what is, you said you were doing wilderness trails. Does that mean you were building trails or maintaining?
Mostly opening trails in the springtime and summer as the snow melted. I was in Wyoming, and there's these huge rock slide areas, and so you have to shovel a lot of rock opening up those trails for the horses and hikers.
Okay.
And then trees come down in the winter too with avalanches.
Yeah, I'd imagine. Yeah, there's we have, the trails that I run on, we get trees that fall. I mean, just as a matter of course. I mean, but it's the Midwest, and you know, usually it's like windstorms. Or I don't even know why. Sometimes I was out running one time and I heard a tree fall, and I'm glad that I'm not under them when they come down. But so yeah, that's part of our trail maintenance as well. But I would imagine, what does an avalanche do to a trail?
Yeah, it can make a mess. I mean, it'll just be trees all jack piled up on the trails. And since it was wilderness, we were using crosscut saws, so it was an added challenge.
Oh my God! So you didn't even like have a chainsaw with you?
No, the trails that were closer to trailheads, we were supposed to use crosscuts.
Just curious, why not haul a chainsaw in? Is it just the problems?
It's part of the wilderness rules.
Okay.
We're not supposed to use chainsaws. Of course, I fight fire in the wilderness a lot, and we often get an exemption. But we do have crosscut saws if that exemption isn't allowed.
Wow.
And yeah. So we're not supposed to have anything motorized.
Okay, that's interesting. I knew they prevented motor vehicles, but... didn't know that exchange extended to chainsaws. That's
So with trail maintenance, they prefer not to have chainsaws for fighting wildfires. Often make a bad exemption.
Yeah, I would imagine, because what's the difference in cutting with a crosssaw? I mean, a chainsaw, I know you can cut through a log in 30 seconds or so. what does it take to cut cut with a crosscut saw? Well, and how big? I mean the crosscut saw I'm envisioning, I've got one in that just for small branches, and it's just a small bow saw. So what do you mean when you say a crosscut saw?
It's usually, if you ever have seen Timber Sports, it's a double box saw, so there'll be a person on either side.
Okay.
It'll be, 4 feet long.
Okay. So not a small one, and
no,
yeah, and not one that you have by yourself. Not one you run by yourself. Okay, that would still require a lot of work and not be quite as fast.
Yeah, and coordination with the other person, and just really making good choices where you're going to cut, because it does take a while.
Yeah. So, and I'm imagining, I'm thinking about the way that works, the weight of the saw. I mean, you can't really, I mean, your motion has got to be rather precise, I would imagine, because you're pulling.
I used to race crosscut saws, so in the sport arena, timber sports arena, and there we have, the saws are as aggressive as we can make them to cut as fast as we can, but you have to be as strong as the saw is sharp. it'll just catch in there.
Okay, I guess I've heard. I didn't know. I've seen, timber sports, in magazines and maybe a little bit on TV. And first thing that comes to mind is log rolling. But I've seen the tree climbing and some of that. They have a spot for hand. Basically with a handsaw.
Yeah. They do single buck or double buck. So you can just be yourself with the saw or two people. And then, I competed in log rolling, speed climbing, hot sawing, axe throwing. It's usually fun.
Axe throwing, okay. That sounds...
And that actually, it's nice because then that I had that skill, and then when I was using the tools in the woods, it translates a little bit,
okay.
especially the climbing.
Okay, so were you competing in that? Which came first, the being in the woods doing trail maintenance, or competing in timber? Was that one of the sports that you kind of got into? Is like, oh, this could be a fun thing to check out.
I got into it in college, and it was just because where I grew up, a woman from Wisconsin moved there, and she opened a show, so people would come and watch those sports.
Okay.
And so I didn't know anything about it, even though there are colleges in Maine that have timber sports teams.
Okay.
So I got into it in college, and it was just kind of a brief time period. 3 years that I did it.
So I'd imagine there's some technique to it. You can't put too much pressure on the blade. I mean, you have to kind of control the pressure you have on the blade, and balance that with your strength and everything. So I would imagine there would be some technique to it. I was like, well, it's kind of like wood splitting. I mean, well, an axe throwing. I mean, there's a lot of coordination, I'd imagine, and timing that you've got to learn to participate like any other sport.
Yeah. And even using a chainsaw, depending on the power of the chainsaw, you know, you can only put so much pressure on it, and it will bog down if you have too much pressure. So it's finding that balance.
Yeah, yeah. So that's there's a whole new realm of sport I hadn't considered. That's like so you did that. What led you from being on the line to saying I want to jump out of airplanes?
Well, I had just been working on. I started on a Forest Service engine, and then went to a hotshot crew because that's a good way to travel around the country and experience fire in a lot of different states. And then I did a year on Helitack.
Is that hotshot crew where you walk in with a small crew to find small fires? Is that the kind of the idea?
No, we're usually 21 people, and we often get called to fires that are getting bigger.
Okay.
So with 21 people, we can build line pretty quickly.
Okay.
But we do hike in, or we just have trucks.
So. You have trucks. You probably drive as close
drive
as you
as
can, and then go through. Okay. That you said. Then you did helicopter.
I did Helitack. Yep. So that one, you know, our vehicle is a helicopter. So sometimes we can't land anywhere near the fire, but we'll land and then hike in, and we'll hook the bucket up to the bottom of the helicopter so it can drop water on the fire if there's water to be had.
Okay. Okay.
And so, then we'll hike in and work below it.
So what is the role of a smoke jumper? I mean, I've seen pictures, you know, of that, but what's kind of the role? I know you jump out of an airplane into places where the fire is going.
Yeah, so yeah, I breathed a lot of dust this week.
Oh.
It's still working its way through my lungs. Yes, so with a smoke jumper, there's usually 8 of us on the airplane. And as many of us will jump as are needed for that fire. So sometimes it will just be one tree or maybe a quarter acre. And so sometimes only 2 of us will jump. But between 2 and 8, and then we can call for more if we need more. And because we're a smaller group, we end up splitting up usually and kind of problem solving and trying to patch some line around the fire and use natural barriers. Link those together to stop the fire. So using fields and rock bands and stuff like that. But really when we get to the ground, we're just like any other firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
The same job. We have tools in our boxes and we have chainsaws dropped to us. And so it's all the same. But we can often get to fires that would take hours to drive to or are totally inaccessible except for foot by foot.
Okay.
Yeah, so we can get there. Yeah, we can fly from Colorado to California in a couple hours and be there pretty quickly.
So is the kind of the theory is that you can find a fire that's small and can contain it before it gets big?
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay.
So we can get there. But we also, our crews, we have a lot of experience on the crew, and we're able to manage fires that are getting bigger, so sometimes we're just called because they need us to manage the incident and kind of organize everyone that's coming in and call for the resources that are needed until other people get there.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a team. So you'll hear, you know, there'll be like a type 2 or type 1 team on these big fires, but it takes a while for all those people to get together and get to that area, so we can jump in and just help out with the being overhead on the fire. So it really varies. Sometimes we jump roads, sometimes we jump in the middle of nowhere, sometimes the fire is one tree, sometimes it's already 10,000 acres.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you said you can get into places that are remote, once you decide that you're done, what do you do to leave? I mean, do you have to hike miles and miles out?
Sometimes we have to hike miles and miles out. There seems to be more aviation every year, so often we can get a helicopter to at least sling our gear out, because each of us has over 135 pounds to carry when we're coming off these fires. with all our tools and camping gear and all our jump gear and our parachutes and everything. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we have to carry it all off, and sometimes we can get a ride on a helicopter. Sometimes our gear gets blown off and we hike. Sometimes a vehicle is able to work its way pretty close. It's really the gamut.
So what brought you into running ultra marathons? Because that's your job, and then for fun you go out and run ultra marathons. How did that develop?
So I kind of randomly started my first year fighting fire. I was just exploring a lot of different jobs, seasonal jobs, and so I decided to try fire for a year. And my engine boss said, "Make sure you're running," because we do a lot of running for physical training. And I really didn't run up until that time. So I was 30 and like, okay, I guess I'll run. And Born to Run had come out somewhat recently, and I'd read that, and I was like, gosh, it would be nice to like running. I explored the barefoot running and just more running lighter, because running was always pretty painful for me. So really it was getting into Wildland Fire got me running, because that's what we do as a group. And then just in the reading, I mean, I was living in Ouray, Colorado, so Hard Rock goes right through there. Mm-hmm. And so I knew ultra marathon runners and had seen that race come through. And I don't know, I got intrigued by what people could do and figured I'd explore that. So I went from a marathon to a 50 miler in a couple months. And was like, I wasn't planning on trying 100, and then people just assumed since I'd run an ultra, it meant I'd run 100. So I was like, all right, I guess I'll do that. And that was kind of how I got into smoke jumping, too. People were like, oh, you're a smoke jumper? I was like, no, I'm a hot shot. They're like, oh, you jump out of planes? No, no. Like, what is this smoke jumping thing? I guess I'll try it. So I don't know. If I hear things more than a few times, then I figure I should look into it.
Yeah, and for those of us who don't live in the West, I mean, we see the stuff on the news, but as far as fires, but not familiar with all the terms of the different crews. Yeah. But
exactly.
So, what was your first ultra?
My first ultra was Old Goat 50 in the Cleveland National Forest in California. Because I had the winter, I'd done my first marathon. It was the Moab Trail Marathon. That's in November. So I was trying to find something before I went back to work. So California had some ones that weren't in the snow. So I did that. It had a lot of elevation gain. It was pretty technical. It was a good starter. I'm more of a hiker than a runner, so it worked out.
Yeah. Well, and that's so nice.
And then they have a 100 miler, so. That was my first 100.
So you went back and did 100 there too as well?
Yeah. Yeah, they have it. It's a different time of year, but it's the same race director and a lot of the same runners.
Yeah. So what did you do beyond that then? When did you your first 100, did you go with longer distances then too?
So I did the 50, and then that fall, some of the people I'd met at that race went and did rim to rim to rim in the Grand Canyon that spring. So as soon as I got done with my hot shot season, I went and did that on my own. And then I think I did the 50 again, and then I decided that I'd try the 100 miler, which again was right after a hot shot season. So it was challenging. I'm not the fastest at the end of my seasons, but I know how to suffer and can carry, go up steep hills.
Yeah, and you're running the hundreds in the mountains too. I mean, you live in the West, so you're doing mountain hundreds, not flatland.
Yeah, so I did that first 100, and it was mountainous, and then I decided, even though my plan had been to stop doing ultras at that point, but instead I signed up for one in Alaska a couple of months later, because it had the added challenge of being flat, being cold, being dark.
So was that the one? I don't. Was it in the Yukon?
This one was the Susitna, so it's just north of Anchorage.
North of Anchorage. Okay. So was that when you had was there was somebody that that I talked to at a previous episode, Mandy Miller, who they had to pull a sled. I mean, it was dark. It was in the dark, and you had to pull a sled. Was that the very similar to what you did?
Yep. They're pulling a sled. There's most of the races. They have a list of required gear, and it's really just much easier to pull it in the sled than putting it in a backpack.
Uh huh.
So, but I've done a few of those now.
So, winter time. So it's dark pretty much all the whole time.
Yeah, there's maybe 8 hours of daylight.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, it was. So it was not up high enough north to be dark all night, the whole time. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. So what was that like? I mean, you're running in a lot of times in the heat, for your work, and then go to Alaska for the cold. How did you adapt to that?
I don't know. I mean, it's all just about paying attention to your surroundings, changing layers and feeding yourself right and drinking. And, I don't know. I was used to that. Self-maintenance somewhere in the hundreds.
You probably already know that I'm a mindset coach, but you may not know exactly what it is that a mindset coach does. Here is the simple answer. If you've ever heard someone say or said yourself, I know what I need to do, but I just can't seem to get myself to do it. That resistance to doing the things that you want to do, that we say that we want to do, that resistance comes from your mindset. And I work with people who think they need to have motivation. They're trying to increase their motivation, and I teach these people to quit relying upon motivation, because motivation won't give you the success. You'll end up stuck saying, I know what I need to do, but I just can't find the motivation to get myself to do it. That's being stuck. See, motivation isn't enough to give you success. You can't rely on motivation to get you through a 100-mile ultramarathon. In order to do that kind of thing, you need a strong mindset. And a strong mindset is going to get you to your goal, whether you're running ultramarathons or whether you're creating an epic life. That's what I do as a mindset coach. I help you develop a strong mindset to get you to get you past that feeling stuck and feeling unmotivated, and what can you do? Contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. I offer you a free 25-minute conversation that can help you get started getting yourself unstuck, creating yourself a mindset that will give you success, whether you want to run far or create an epic life. That's ultramindsetpodcast.run. Scroll to the bottom if you're on your phone. Look at the sidebar if you are on your computer, and find the calendar there and schedule a 25-minute conversation with me. Yeah. So we were talking about being in Alaska and running there. So what was the weather like? What kind of temperatures did you face there?
It really, and I've done 3 races in Alaska now, and it never got below -20. So, it's actually a little bit more of a challenge when you're pulling a sled when it's closer to freezing temperatures, getting that high, like in the 20s, because everything is softer. So there's a lot more friction with the sled, and you're punching through the snow with your feet more. So it's almost better the colder it is, and to a certain point.
Uh-huh. And, well, negative 20 isn't, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not too bad. I mean, that's...
But it's not too bad, especially if the wind's... Yeah, the wind.
Depending on the wind.
The factor. It can be pretty cold at zero if it's windy.
Yeah. I live in Kansas City, and Kansas, seen some 20 below here. It doesn't happen all the time, but I've been out in 20 below, and it's like, yeah, I don't. Yeah, well, I think I even ran. Uh-huh. It was close to that. So, You have to be careful with it. You have to take some precautions. But so what did you have to do? Did you have to thaw your water out? How did you keep your water from freezing?
I just had insulated thermoses, and then I put hot water in there. So I have one that holds almost it's like 3 quarts. I think it holds. So that one stays thawed for many hours. Yeah.
Okay. So what kind of time did it take you to do
that? Those have cut off to 48 hours, and the first one I finished just under 40 hours. Yeah. So it's
okay.
I mean, they're definitely slower hauling all that weight. So.
Yeah. So how deep did you have to? You say you were breaking through snow sometimes. Was there a path
or trail? Because so there's snowmobiles and a lot of snowmobile traffic in Alaska. That's one of the main ways they get around. So we're often following those trails. So the only time it became a challenge was when you had those winds, because then the snow would blow and make drifts. And so there were times that we'd be fighting to get through the drifts here, breaking trail. Ideally, it's hard pack. It's cold.
Yeah.
It's hard pack. Easy trail to follow, but ends up being variable, especially over a couple days. The conditions change a lot.
Mm-hmm. Running in deep snow for those who have not run in deep snow, and that's even walking. It just if it gets to be 10 inches or so of snow, it's. It's worse than trying to run in soft sand.
Sand makes for good training material, though.
Yes, it does. It does. So, what does your training look like when you're thinking about? Do you just kind of? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're pretty active on your job. Is that kind of what you do for training?
Yeah,
for
I mean, during the season, I'm really just concentrating on work. So, I try to get to the gym when I can, and we do a lot of push-ups and pull-ups and in our spare time, and then we're getting a workout on the job. And then in the fall, it really changes for me when I get home. I start going to CrossFit pretty regularly and running regularly. I try to run during the summer as well, but sometimes there's not a lot of daylight hours left. So try to do what I can, and then it kind of depends where I'm stationed, if I can get runs in between fires. And then, I don't know, I'm always one, if it's powder day, I'm going to go skiing, and if it's good skiing conditions, I'll do that, or I'll go climbing, go to yoga, gym. I really try to keep it varied, because I like a lot of different sports and hang out with different people, so as long as I'm feeling comfortable, like with the long winter ultramarathons, I want to be comfortable with my equipment and clothing and all of that. So I'll train a decent amount to make sure that I'm not going to have any issues with that. And then, training for the snow. I mean, you don't have to go very many miles to get a good workout. So it's usually just time spent out in the snow versus miles.
Yeah. So, what is skate skiing?
You said something. Nordic skiing. So there's classic skiing, which is where your skis are side by side, and then skate skiing, where you're pretty much skating in the skis, but it has to be a groomed
okay.
smooth course for the most part.
So that's different than cross country.
Skiing is Nordic skiing, and then there's different types. Yeah.
Is Nordic skiing okay? So the difference. So skate skiing would be climbing.
Yeah,
kind of
and it tends to be faster. So
cross country skiing.
It's pretty popular with the runners here because you're getting your heart rate up super high and moving pretty quickly. Just another way to get that running workout in without running. because sometimes it's
well, that helps. It works.
There's a lot of snow, and you can still run the trails, but. Put skis on sometimes.
Well, and it would work different muscles too. I mean, I found that when I try to do something, A lot of times you think, well, I'm a runner. I can go off and do, I can do this other thing as well. You find out that's a whole different set of muscles to be used. And you have the aerobic endurance, but
you're good for runners. I've found just, doing skiing or workouts at the gym, it's using different muscles, but that, I think, protects those joints and makes you stronger, especially if you're running sand or snow. Or technical trails, where there's it's not as straightforward, and sometimes you end up using those accessory muscles more. So I think it balances everything out, makes for a stronger runner, especially over those long distances.
Yeah, and for those who don't live where there's snow, you could probably do inline skating and get something similar to that kind of a workout. You say you climb as well?
Climb and rock climb a little bit. I'm usually working during those seasons, but try to get out a couple times a year somewhere outdoors. And then there's gyms everywhere, so I'll go with friends sometimes to the climbing gym.
So have you done climbed any?
Yeah.
The peaks. Do you have any kind of ice climbing adventures?
Yeah, I actually, right after college, I went to Ecuador and Peru and ended up climbing Cotopaxi, which is, I believe, the highest active volcano in the world. It was just over 19,000 feet. I had no idea what I was getting into then, but made it to the top of that, and then a couple of years ago went down to Mexico and did the highest peak in Mexico. Which was nice. Anytime I'm not in my fire boots carrying a big fire pack, I'm pretty happy.
I would imagine that would condition you for doing some things definitely. Like climbing like that. So 19,000.
Oh, just
go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, with the work too, it helps with those winter races of kind of the slower, more methodical running, pulling weight. It's mentally pretty similar, just digging in, head down.
Well, and I'd imagine that you're firefighting, you're doing, you're hiking, probably similar to what a ultramarathon runner does is power hiking. I would say you call power hiking. Yeah. Is that very similar? Because imagine with that much gear that you carry, you really aren't running, but you're really trying to get across the landscape as quickly as possible. Yeah. So 19,000 feet is did you do any conditioning to get that high?
No, they brought us up. We had a couple days up at higher elevations. When I did the peak in Mexico, we slept pretty low. We slept at like 10,000 feet, which I'm used to working and playing at 10,000 feet. This last fire that I just got off, we were up at 11,000 every day working. So I was used to that. So we did the night before the summit at 10,000, so it was really good sleep, and then we just went up really quickly and back down. So I liked that instead of trying to sleep up at 13,000, 14,000 feet. That's pretty miserable.
You have a somewhat an advantage over a lot of runners. I know a runner who runs at sea level all the time, and people who do that and then have to go up to the mountains, oftentimes the altitude is a big issue.
Yeah, I don't have issues with the altitude. Unfortunately, with work, by the fall, I've been breathing in so much smoke and dust that I'm not really conditioned for running. I've tried to do a few hundred milers in the fall.
Oh.
And, I was just kind of struggling respiratorily. So, the legs felt good and everything, but it just ended up kind of being too slow. But by the springtime, usually feeling good and able to race better.
So do your lungs, it takes a while for your lungs to clear out from everything you do for work?
Yeah, a month and a half or so. Like, you can hear how raspy I am right now. That's from 21 days breathing dust.
Yeah, hadn't considered that aspect of the job. You'd imagine is that something that's long term? That's a health issue for firefighters.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of information on it. But I mean, we love working outdoors, and so I mean, there's long term risks of sitting in an office too. So I guess we just take it for what it is. I mean. You get the winds. Yeah.
That's a great answer.
So I won't have carpal tunnel. I'll probably have arthritis in the elbows and hands.
And I know that a lot of people who live in living in the cities, you talk about working in an office, living in the city or even running, oftentimes the air quality in the city isn't a whole lot better for you. I'd imagine, that your lungs do mm-hmm. Clear themselves out. They can adapt to that. So that's interesting. So do you have any goal races, anything that you have ahead of you that you...
There's a whole lot of ones that take place in the summer that I know I can't do anytime soon with this job, but I'm liking the ones that are longer than 100. I'd like to try one of the 200 or 300 mile ones. So I was looking at the Cocodona, which I might be able to pull off, but you had mentioned the Yukon, and I've been eyeing another multi-day one. It's in the Yukon versus Alaska, but on the Yukon Quest Trail. And it would be, I think it has a 2-week cutoff. So it'll be multiple days pulling a sled, eyeing that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, I really enjoy the races in Utah and Arizona in the winters. So, most of the longer ones, though, are in the summer. And that was why I ended up doing a lot of the snow ones, because that's the time I have off. Work around work.
Yeah, so the fire season ends in the fall, and then it comes to you. So how much time do you have free when you're off?
Each year varies a little bit. So last year I finished work end of October. I'll often finish early October. It just kind of depends what I need to do for just to get the hours that I need. Because I'll work a year's worth of hours in those 6 months, but sometimes it takes 7 months to get the hours that I need to make it through the winter. And then we're back at work. We start back with everyone very end of March, beginning of April. So I usually have... it takes a month to get all settled at home, and usually travel and see family a little bit first, and then start training full time pretty much in November. So it's a short training season. I'll train November, December, and start racing. I'm not winning any races. Let's make that clear.
Well, the appeal for most of us who go out to run ultramarathons is to be, out on the trail, moving across the countryside on under our own power.
Yeah, and that's
just being out there.
My job requires me to be in shape year round, so there's training going on year round. And with ultramarathons, a lot of it is mindset and. Being able to take care of yourself out there. So I have that going year round. And the ultra marathons, they definitely helped when I started smoke jumping, because that's a little bit more intense, especially the initial training. So the ultra marathons set me up really well, speaking of mindsets, for that training.
So what do you do when you're, as far as your mindset work to for both smoke jumping and your running? Do you do you do intentional work to set yourself to be able to do that?
I think just over time and with experience, you know, you learn that, you know, if you're tired or hurting, it's not going to get exponentially worse, most likely. So just knowing that bodies are fickle and just pushing through hard times and knowing that it might get easier or might stay harder and knowing it's just part of the journey and the experience and isn't going to kill you. So enjoying it. Enjoying your surroundings, you know, while you're there to begin with.
So have you had times when you're at ultramarathon runners talking about, you know, the dark, your mind getting kind of dark and feeling hopeless. Have you ever had to go through any of those times in your runs?
Yeah, I mean,
work
gets hard. You know, we'll pull all-nighters often when it's initial attack, so we'll show up to a fire. A lot of times they get reported in the afternoon, so we're getting there as the sun sets. And so we'll have some late nights. And so it's similar to that, you know, when you're doing 100 milers, and that it's that nighttime that really makes it the challenge, because your body's telling you to go to sleep and you got to keep doing it. And then you start wondering why you're there going through that. So it's pretty similar.
Yeah. Well, thank you a lot, Martha, for being here. I appreciate your time. Before I let you go, I have the bridge questions before I let you go.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
I'll put this as... Whether in your firefighting or your running, what is the one piece of gear that you absolutely can't do without?
Obviously, there's like the basics of water, but I'd say with firefighting, the multi-tool, the iPhone, it's our maps, it's our documentation, it's our slope meter. It's like everything now. It's pretty funny.
Wow. So do you... Is there service
always,
that far out?
Maps downloaded and a lot of stuff to work with on offline. So. I mean, there's all the basics.
That's cool.
Our boots, we can't our fire boots or whatever. I'm not real good at questions like the one thing. It's always a kit.
Well, yeah. Well, I know that's tough because there a lot of people, you know, a lot of runners say, well, right. Shoes, you gotta have the right shoes. And I'm like, well, you know,
yeah.
you read Born to Run, and it's like there are runners that are out there who run with,
yeah.
with
I mean,
very,
I'm
very
out,
little on their feet.
I did a couple runs last year just in my rainbow flip-flops. I'm like, yeah, most of the world runs in sandals. Let's do that.
Well, that would be hard because
you
don't have anything around your heel.
Hang on.
Yeah, I would imagine. But yeah, it can be done. Yep. I mean, flip flops work. So, you've been outside for a lot. What is the strangest thing you've ever seen out in your travels?
Strangest thing. Well, I'd say in Utah in the desert, we often would have meteorites when they hit the ground, right? But we would have meteorites coming through, and so we'd get like flaming balls of fire coming down towards us in the woods. And that happened more often than anywhere else out in the Utah desert. That was always disconcerting when you see your shadow in the middle of the day from some material burning the atmosphere. So,
yeah. did you actually see them hit the ground?
Off before, but yeah.
Yeah. They all burned off before they got there. Okay. But they were bright enough to light up and throw a shadow. Oh wow. Yeah, that would be a little bit disconcerting. Yeah, because. Yeah. I could see that. So what word or phrase, this is the last question, what word or phrase is your philosophy of life?
I'd say flexibility, which then makes you adaptable. I'd say flexibility.
That's a good one. And I think you exemplify that with that you're in a position that
it keeps you from getting frustrated when things go as you don't expect. That's what you should expect, is they don't go as you expect.
And for most ultra marathon runners, that's like, yep. That
shouldn't have expectations, but don't have them too specific. And you're there for that experience.
That kind of mindset to have your plan, and expect that you're going to have to adapt it once you get cross once we cross the starting line. It's like so many variables. Well, thank you a lot, Martha. Hope things go well for your travels and for the rest of this season. Where can people if they wanted to hear this and wanted to connect with you or follow you?
It's all private.
Active.
Yeah. So it's okay. But they can search and message me on Instagram or Facebook, and I check those messages. Yeah. Right now, though, nothing public.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I appreciate it. And they can look up, they can find your name in the show notes, and they can reach out to you if they want to. So that sounds good. Okay. Well, thank you a lot, Martha. I appreciate it. Have a safe.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, it was good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the 100th episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast Trail Talk. If you know somebody who has a good story to share, I would love to have a referral. I'm always looking for great guests. You can contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. There's a place there to record a voice message, or you can reach out. There's a contact form as well. You can do by text. You can also find at ultramindsetpodcast.run show notes. And at the 25-minute consultation, you can have a conversation with me about mindset. There's also affiliate links there to Amazon. If you'd like to buy stuff through Amazon, doesn't cost you any more, and helps me keep things going here, keeps the lights on here at the podcast. There's also an online course, Crush Your Goals, with a bonus content of how to defeat cravings. Those things are all there at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find the Crush Your Goals course. You get a 20% discount if you enter the word podcast, all capital letters, podcast, and you get 20% off of the already bargain price. The Crush Your Goals course is the best that I offer to my clients about mindset for getting your goals and for reducing your dealing with cravings, crush your cravings. Those are just a very short course, just packed with information. Check that out if you would like some help on getting better towards your goals. Remember, a strong mindset is what you need for success, whether running or in life, and developing a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.